Now, new details about one of the most sensational and most debated trials of the 20th century. Last month, a federal judge ordered the government to release almost all of the grand jury transcripts in the case against Julius and Ethel Rosenbergs. The Rosenbergs were executed in 1953 for handing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. The files released last Thursday include more than 900 pages of testimony. Some raise questions about Ethel Rosenberg's role and about government tactics. In an associated development, Morton Sobel, a co-defendant, confessed to the New York Times that he was a Soviet spy. He also said Julius was too, but that Ethel was only guilty of being his wife. The Rosenbergs went to the electric chair protesting their innocence until now. Sobel, who served 30 years in prison, insisted he was innocent too. We'll talk with the lead attorney who argued for the release of the records and with an expert on the history of Cold War espionage. If you'd like to speak with them about the details of the transcripts, what they tell us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. David Vladek is the lawyer who argued for the release of the transcripts on behalf of the National Security Archive, among other plaintiffs. He's with us here today in Studio 3A. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And what have we learned? What's the most interesting thing?
Well, it's hard to know where to start. This is really a treasure trove for historians. Most people who are familiar with the prosecution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg worry about whether the evidence used to convict Ethel was adequate. And here, there are some real insights about whether the testimony against her, the key testimony at trial, was whether that she typed up the notes of David Greenglass, her brother, bombing the atomic secrets that were stolen and then transmitted to the Soviets. So both David Greenglass and his wife, Ruth Greenglass, testified at trial that Ethel had actually typed up these notes that Julius then conveyed to the Soviets. Well, neither of their grand jury testimonies support that. And indeed, Ruth, in her grand jury testimony, acknowledges that she committed the crime that Ethel was convicted for and executed for. Her grand jury testimony says quite directly that she is the one who printed out in longhand David's notes, which were then transmitted for the Soviets. And we know because of Soviet intercepts that were ultimately secured by the United States and ultimately declassified. Right, that the material the Soviets got on this was in longhand. And so we have Ruth Greenglass in her grand jury testimony essentially confessing to the crime that her sister-in-law was convicted and executed for.
And for a long time, people felt that the government had, in fact, gone hard against Ethel Rosenberg in hopes that her husband would then turn around and provide information about other people who were members of the ring. And is that supported?
Oh, yes. And the government acknowledged that. Bill Rogers, who had supervised the litigation, basically said, look, we wanted to pressure the Rosenbergs to confess. We went hard after Ethel to secure Julius's confession. All of the preceding Soviet spies who had been caught had confessed. His line was, she called our bluff. Now, this isn't to say that she was an innocent at sea. I mean, she helped recruit David to go, steal these secrets in the first place. She plainly understood what her husband was doing. Whether she would have gotten the death penalty for that kind of conduct, hard to imagine.
John Earl Haynes is also with us here in Studio 3A. He's a co-writer of several books dealing with Soviet espionage and is an historian at the Library of Congress. Good of you to come in today, too.
Delighted to be here.
And what do you make of these documents that have finally been made available?
Well, indeed, they are a treasure trove from the point of view of historians because they have a great deal of information and testimony that did not come out at the trial because it was not directly relevant to the questions that were at issue in the trial itself, particularly on Julius Rosenberg's involvement in scientific espionage in other areas. There's a great deal of information in these grand jury records.
Stealing things like information about the proximity fuse, radars, artillery, that sort of thing.
Yes, and particularly I found the testimony of William Pearl, who did go to prison for perjury, for denying knowing Rosenberg. But there's a great deal of information in his testimony about the kinds of projects he was involved in. And he was, I think, in the eyes of historians, probably the most valuable of Julius Rosenberg's engineer spies.
Yet, what about this question of Ethel Rosenberg's involvement?
Well, my own view is that, indeed, Ruth may have embellished the evidence about the typing. Whether that made the difference in the minds of the jury to convict her, I don't know. Even without the typing a bit, the grand jury indicted her. One has to keep that in mind.
This was the Cold War, and we always remember the old line from prosecutors that you can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Well, true enough. But I think both from the evidence that's available in Venona about Ethel.
These are the Soviet decrypts.
Right. Yes. And evidence that will come out in a book, which I and Harvey Clare are publishing next year, based on new KGB archival material. They will show that while Ethel certainly was not any kind of a major spy, she was much more than the little woman back in the kitchen. She took an active role in her husband's espionage activity. Let me point out, for example, that one of the messages, which was decoded, mentions that that Ethel was aware of two of Julius's agents, Meter and Nile. Well, Meter, the FBI was able to identify, it was Joel Barr. They were never able to identify Nile. And he has remained unidentified to this day. Ethel knew who Nile was. And we will identify who Nile was next year, and he was an interesting spy. And so she had secrets to hide.
Nevertheless, the question we heard earlier from David Vladek, enough to have sent her to the electric chair?
Well, no. There are two separate questions. One is whether she was a party to a conspiracy to commit espionage. I think she was clearly guilty of that. The other is a matter of whether you think the death penalty was appropriate. I personally don't think it was appropriate in Ethel's case. But do also keep in mind that the Rosenbergs had the power at any point to save themselves. All they had to do was confess and cooperate. Hmm. They chose death.
And given that, David Vladek, what do you make of Morton Sobel after all of these years? There was no rally too small for him to appear at to deny that he was involved in any of this.
And Morton Sobel participated in this litigation by giving us a declaration asking the court to unseal these records. I had talked to him on a number of occasions. Each time he unequivocally declared his innocence. My suspicion is that with the revelation of these transcripts, much of which sort of confirms John's point about this very broad net of Soviet espionage, not directed principally at the atomic secrets, but conventional but highly important other defensive systems, Morty thought the jig was up, that it would no longer be plausible for him to maintain his claim of innocence in light of all of this evidence. I'd like to get back to Ethel for just 1 minute.
Sure. Now we get some calls in, 800-989-8255.
What convicted her were two things. One is it was Irvin Sapel, the prosecutor, describing how keystroke by keystroke she transmitted Soviet secrets. This was the exact testimony that was cited by the judge in sentencing her to the death. But the other thing was that the principal evidence against her trial was simply her communist affiliations. Part of what happened in this trial was the major thrust of this case was these people were communists, which, of course, they were. But that's what convicted her, not the fact that she and David may have had some conversation that inclined David to engage in spying. And certainly the grand jury was unaware of the kinds of information that that came out in Venona. So, you know, it does raise very serious questions about whether Ethel, not Julius, whether Ethel got a fair trial here.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Bill. Bill with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Well, you know, this whole thing about the Rosenbergs, and I saw that the release of that information, it's really got me perplexed because the Rosenbergs, I believe, the research I did for my book, the Rosenbergs weren't atomic spies. They were spies, and I think they were double agents because the Russians had the atomic bomb secrets and enough nuclear material to jumpstart their program prior to the end of World War II, and it was supplied by the United States. So for us to be trying Ethel and Julius Rosenberg for giving them the atomic secrets was preposterous, except that it was a cosmetic. It was just cosmetics. They brought this case to give the public the perception that, oh, the Russians got the bomb because they stole it from us.
From my reading of history, and certainly John Earl Haynes, you know a lot more about this than I do. The information that the Rosenberg supplied was not that important, but not that it wasn't stolen. It was stolen by another guy named Ted Hall, who was also a spy, and he was at Los Alamos.
Well,
I'm sorry, Bill. I just wanted to ask John Earl Haynes that.
I don't agree with the caller's premise. I think there was indeed a Soviet nuclear program that was underway, but the Soviet Union was under tremendous pressure during World War II for conventional weaponry. The Soviet program was very small. They did not have any kind of supply of bomb-grade uranium, and they depended very heavily after the war on the information that came to them from atomic spies in the West, principally from Klaus Fuchs, from Ted Hall, from several major sources in Great Britain. David Greenglass was, you know, he assisted in that, but he wasn't one of the major.
Not from want of trying.
Well, let me take that a step further. After the Rosenbergs were convicted, the Rosenberg lawyers went to a series of top flight physicists to try to get the physicists to say that the information Julius supplied the Soviets was not of important value. By and large, they wouldn't do it. By and large, the view of, and these were people of all political stripes, by and large, the view was this was important information, particularly the shape and the technology built into the implosion device, the trigger for this nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there certainly were other spies at Los Alamos. There's no question about that. Whether the Rosenberg contribution to this was negligible or not, most physicists would not agree with that.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is two congressional investigations concluded that Harry Hopkins, who was FDR's aide in charge of the Lend-Lease program, supplied the Soviets with the atomic secret and with enough nuclear material to get the program started. I think that the Rosenbergs were double spies working for us. They shouldn't have been executed, but they went down that road. And since we have people who are willing to jump in front of a bullet for the president, it's not so far of a leap to think that you have spies who would be willing to go to the death to take the death penalty to prove a case. This was a disinformation, I believe. I don't think the Rosenbergs really had much to do with anything.
An interesting theory, Bill. Thanks very much for the phone call. We're talking about new revelations, new details from the grand jury testimony involving Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Jesse on the line. Jesse with us from Syracuse in New York.
Hi. I wanted to know if, in light of all the, you know, the things that have come out about the Rosenbergs now and, you know, the spy network, is the paranoia, I guess, displayed by McCarthy and Nixon, do you think that's more justified now? And I'll take my answer off the air.
That's an interesting question. What do you think, David Lotta?
I don't think it was justified then. I don't think it was justified now. I do think, and there are many ways to look at this. One of our historians has argued that the Rosenberg case is sort of evidence of the greatest counter-espionage failure in U.S. history. That is, these were amateurs. They were not trained. They managed to infiltrate the defense establishment and steal some of the most important secrets American weapon systems, proximity fuses, radar, anti-aircraft weapons, all of which were in turn used against our troops in Korea and Vietnam. But another is that these people, the government did have, and John can speak more to this, the government did have some inkling as to what was going on. Because of Venona. And one of the really interesting things about it is how we had this intelligence, but we didn't act on it in an aggressive way, and we certainly didn't prosecute these people, and many
for fear of compromising the source of intelligence.
Right, many would argue for precisely that reason. And so, you know, it'd be interesting to get John's view on this. But I think that doesn't justify McCarthy or Nixon.
Now, McCarthy certainly wasn't briefed on Venona, John?
No, he certainly was not. There's no evidence that he was. McCarthy was the sort of guy that if you told him a secret in the morning that was politically useful, he'd blab it on radio in the afternoon. So if he had been briefed on Venona, we'd have known about it back then, not now. I think there are several parts to this. One is the extent of Soviet espionage, particularly in the scientific, technical, and military areas, is very impressive. But a large part of McCarthy's appeal was not his emphasis on that. It was this emphasis that there were high policy making officials in the U.S. government.
I have in my hand a list of the spies at the State Department.
Yes, at the State Department, and he was pointing at the leading officials of the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. And there he was simply wrong. There's nothing in all of the revelations of Venona or other material that we have that says that penetration at a high-level political level went any further than those who have been identified, Alger Hiss, Lachlan Curry, and Harry Dexter White. Other policy officials that McCarthy pointed to, particularly in the State Department and particularly his pointing at Dean Acheson and others, was simply flat-out wrong.
There is, though, the irony of that David Latica was pointing to, that the Rosenbergs went to the electric chair. Ted Hall was never prosecuted, lived out his life peacefully in England.
Yes, that's right, and that's because under our legal system, it was essentially impossible for the Justice Department to produce the evidence it had against Hall in court. And since they couldn't produce it in court, he went free.
Innocent man, a guilty man went free because of the technical reason they didn't want to expose the Venona decrypts, which would have revealed the source of that intelligence to the Soviet Union.
Right, and you know the idea that our code-breaking agency would allow one of its crypt analysts to be sitting on the stand and explain to a defense lawyer how he broke Soviet codes, that was totally unacceptable.
Thanks very much. Very interesting material, and John Earl Haynes will look forward to your new book next year. John Earl Haynes, the author of co-author of several books dealing with Soviet espionage, including In Denial, Historians, Communism, and Espionage and Venona, Decoding Soviet Espionage in America, with us here in Studio 3A. He's also an historian at the Library of Congress. David Vladek, the lawyer who argued for the release of the grand jury testimony and is a professor of law at Georgetown Law School. Thanks to you both very much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.